Daniel chapter 6, and we'll be in verses 1 through 17. Daniel 6, 1 through 17. I know it's really hard not to tell the whole story, but, you know, I want to take my time on these chapters, and it's been a long time since I've been through Daniel, and I don't think I've actually ever taken as much time in this book particularly. Because it's a story, so you want to tell it. This morning, the sermon title is Deception. And if you've ever been deceived, I have some ideas for you. Because Darius gets hoodwinked, he gets completely deceived in this chapter 6, verses 1 through 17. You know, trying to figure out if people are telling the truth is not an easy task. How many of you in the line of your work get lied to all the time? Absolutely. For those of us who are in a private school, we find out the truth eventually, but it usually takes about 8 weeks for the school's records to come to us, and by then we really don't need them because we've already figured it out, you know, on our own. Oh yeah, now we know. We knew this. Yeah. So, but it's also fun because we have some tools available that the public school does not. And we had one little boy, his file is very thick, and I persuaded the mom to allow us to do corporal punishment, which in the public school, if he threw a fit and threw things and broke things, then they'd attach somebody to him and walk him around the school. Well, that's a whole lot more fun than doing work, right? So the corporal punishment form means he gets a SWAT. So, you know, I explained to him, your mom's has signed this form, so if you don't listen to your teacher, then we're going to give you a spank. You know, so the first one was just a strong enough for him to actually realize all the fun has left the building. It is now no longer fun. And he's, you know, that's been a couple of weeks, and he's actually doing really, really well. Marvin's been involved in watching this process because I always have two people. You know, it's absolutely worth the money. We spend about it's more than that. It's like $400 a year for the privilege of using what our state allows us for free. It's a corporal punishment state. By law in Texas, I don't need anybody's permission to administer a SWAT. However, doing so would put a sign out front that says, sue me. So I always get the permission and make sure that we're very careful with it. But, you know, the reality is I get lied to all the time, and I think you do too. When I was a police chaplain, they sent us chaplains to a seminar. It was a week long, and it was a deception detection, which is kind of a cool term. And I never really realized why would they want their chaplains trained in figuring out if somebody was lying. And the fellow who taught the class was the head of the Highway Patrol of Maryland, and he came down here, and it really, and he'd been doing this for a lot of years, but everything he had to say was based on a book that a guy who did nothing but lie detector tests for 30 years, that's all he did, was administer a lie detector test. He did that day in, day out for 30 years, and then he wrote a book about how people don't tell the truth. And what he figured out was that people's answers take certain tracks and certain directions when they're not telling the truth. It's just, that's what people do. So they lie, but they lie in a specific or a particular way, a particular direction. You know, I had no idea that it would be so valuable to me as a principal to have a seminar on detecting deception. But it actually was helpful as a chaplain too. I remember one case where I was working with a couple, and it was a SIDS death, a dead baby. And there was something wonky about this. You know, I watched a mother and I watched a father, and I was with them for about an hour and a half, and I went out and I told the investigating detective, I said, this man is not grieving normally. And they pulled him aside, and sure enough, he had shaken the baby, and it wasn't SIDS at all. It was a shaken baby syndrome. But I could tell there was something off about it, and that was the center that they sent me to. So once in a while, it came in helpful, but far more useful as a principal than ever as a police chaplain, because the situations are coming up all the time. But having had classes in detecting deception doesn't help when it comes to real life experience, because I am so incredibly gullible that somebody tells me a story and it's got to be true because they told it to me. So we're going to look at that in this chapter, and I'm going to give you a suggestion at the end, but right now I want to talk to you about Darius the Mede. This is in chapter 5. The numbers are off here between the Hebrew and the English, but if you look at what I think is verse 30 in your text, that very night Belshazzar was slain, the king of the Chaldeans, and Darius the Mede took over reign of the kingdom about 62 years of age. So he was about 62, which is kind of interesting why I didn't say about 60, but about 62 years old when Darius became the head of the kingdom. Now, let me just tell you right up front that there's all kinds of divisions and discussions and debates about who this guy is, all right? And his relationship to Cyrus and everything else. So it won't take long, because if you look at verse 38, I think it's, no, 28. So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Okay? What was the nationality? This is extra point. Bonus question, boys and girls. What was the nationality of Darius? He was a Mede. Yeah, so what's a Mede? Well, Medes are an ancient kingdom. You can find it all the way back in Genesis 10, verse 22, descendants of Shem. Elam, he was the one who moved and was the fellow who populated this particular region a little bit north of Babylon. Okay, so Elam became the Median Empire. You'll see him again in Genesis 14, where Chedorlaomer was from that. So this is a very ancient kingdom, and it was relatively small. The Persians, however, were north of the Medes, up underneath the seas up there, and it was what we'd call Iran today. And it was a larger kingdom, but it was more recent. So you'll see in Daniel 7 that the second is greater than the first. The Persian side of the empire expanded a lot more than the Median side of the empire. But this is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Medes were there first and Persians, but they joined forces. It's a dual empire. They had co-reigning kings. Okay? So Darius is the guy who took Babylon, captured Babylon. He's king of the Medes, and he worked with Cyrus, who is king of the Persians. Cyrus, as I understand it, is younger than Darius, but they're two separate guys. That's my opinion. They're not the same. They're different. One's a Mede and one's a Persian. All right, do I want to say anything else about that? Sometimes I think it's just really simple to let the text stand what it is and just accept that it is, and not necessarily try to figure out who they were in history and all those other things. My experience has been you can always trust Scripture 100% of the time, and you ought to be suspicious 100% of the time with anything that doesn't just clearly reconcile itself with Scripture. So Darius the Mede, Cyrus is the one who is in charge of the kingdom. He's superior in some sense to Darius, but it's a co-reign. A little bit of history. I'm not in that big of a hurry because I only have 17 verses. The Median Persian Empire, they were the Walmart of the ancient Near East. Okay, the Medes and the Persians really didn't much care about anything other than taxes. You pay your taxes, we're going to be all right. You don't pay your taxes, we're going to come and we're going to fillet you and place you on a stick in front of all of the city because you're the one who's responsible for not having the bills paid. So they would go and they would conquer by simply sheer numbers and negotiations. Unlike the Assyrians who transplanted people everywhere, and Babylon who brought them into a location near them so they could oversee this population, like the Jews were transported to Babylon so they could watch them. The Persians said, "Oh, you poor people. You didn't want to live in Kansas, did you? You wanted to live in Plano. Come on, we're going to send you back to your home." So they would send them back, but with the understanding that you would pay taxes because you're part of the Persian Empire. So they negotiated with everybody. They became an absolutely insanely huge empire. They were all the way over on the east side of the Indus River in India, all that range, and they were all the way up to the western edge of Turkey. It's a massive, massive empire. That's important because we're going to see in prophecy how these empires continue to fold into the other, not losing the original footprint of that Babylonian and then the Medes and the Persians, and then Greece. Alexander the Great went all the way to the Indus River, and then Rome took that same footprint and expanded all the way up into the British Isles. We'll come to that later. But they were the negotiators. They didn't care who you worship, what your religion was. You had to know the language of the Medes and the Persians. You had to follow their laws. And if you didn't, they would come in and ruthlessly kill a whole bunch of people. But as long as you said, "Hey, I'm fine being a Persian, not a problem. Here's your pay ticket. You can live in peace." All right? So we're all together on that. So Darius is part of this Median Persian Empire. And it's not surprising here that he set up all kinds of stuff. Let's look at verse 1. "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom." So the first thing that he did was establish a system of administration, and the kingdom was, whether this is the Persian part of it or the Median part of it or the entire kingdom, from what I can feel from this chapter, it appears to me that at 62, he was a very good administrator, and he administrated the entire Median-Persian Empire. Verses 2 through 5, we're going to see Daniel rise to power and end up being in trouble because of his failure to embrace the culture. Let's look at verse 2. "From over these governors, there were three, of whom Daniel was one." So 120 down to three. From them, so that Daniel was one of those, so that these satraps might be giving an account to the three, so that the king would not suffer loss. You see the financial hook here. So out of 120, he chose three satraps, or governors they're called, and they ruled the 120. Verse 3, please. "Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." So Daniel, of the three, was the best. Daniel would have been at least 85 years old at this point, assuming he went into captivity at the age of 16. Probably no younger, maybe a year or two older. 16 to 18 would have been about the age that they were looking for in 605 BC. So we're now down to 536 BC when Belshazzar was killed and the Babylonian Empire fell. So, you know, you take that's 69 years plus what however old Daniel was. He's someplace between 85, 86, and 87. He's already been administrating for a lot of years in Babylon. He knew everything that could be known about administration. He's 87 years old. Okay, so he knows what he's doing. And of the three guys, he absolutely is the best. And the king here, Darius, is thinking about making him the entire, in charge of the entire place. So he doesn't have to worry about anything except counting the money. Verse 4. And at once the governors and the satraps, they were searching over Daniel to find something against him. From some side of his management in the kingdom. And every chance that they took, every possible corruption, they were not being able to find anything because he was believing in God. He was a person who absolutely had no error or no fault in him. So in verse 5, these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So they look at Daniel and try to find some problem with him. Now, you know, I don't know about how you manage to try to stay out of trouble with the government. I work really hard at that to keep our church and school and myself out of trouble with the government. But you know, the tax law is really, really complicated. And I use TurboTax. How many of you all use TurboTax? Okay. So, you know, I have two LLCs and a sole proprietorship. And I'm trying to keep all of these numbers straight. I'm only working off of receipts. If I get audited, I think I can justify it. But what I got through with TurboTax here recently, I have a 99.9% chance of being audited and I can't file my taxes electronically. You know why? Well, because I got a W-2 form and it has no income on it. It has only housing allowance, so I have to file it by mail. So I wrote up a letter and said, you know, this is why, and this is, you know, what I've done, and I left money on the table. So if there's a problem, you know, at least they owe me money. That's the hope. But I promise you, if they start examining me the way Daniel was examined, I'd fail the test. Daniel was so good and so honest that they could find nothing. And he's got two other governors and 120 satraps under him that he's managing. And there's no graft, there's no bribery, there's nothing. And these guys, they examined him one side to the other and said, "Hey, the only way we're going to hang this guy out to dry is if we can find some way to catch him on his law, because he follows the Jewish law." So this is anti-Semitism at its height. And they figure out a way to do that. Let's look, please, now at verses 6 through 9. So we'll see evil legislation against this culture contrarian that's named Daniel. Evil legislation. So just because something's legal doesn't make it right. I have argued that my entire ministry career because it's a biblical issue. But now in my own experience, I'm finding that there are laws being passed which are wrong. We cannot follow those laws. What a world. So the governors, these governors, satraps, they thronged before Darius, this is kind of fun. At once, immediately, these men coming in saying, we will not find anything against Daniel unless if it's against his God. Now please, verse 6. And at once, immediately, all at once, the governors and these satraps, they thronged, went as a gang, went as a group before the king. And this is what they were saying to him. O Darius, the king, the one living to the ages forever, may that be your experience. They have consulted among themselves, so they're speaking not only for themselves, but all of the governors of the kingdom and the prefects and the satraps and the counselors and the advisors. We have all counseled among ourselves to establish a regulation of the king to enforce or to firmly make a law or a decree that all requests, every request from any god, from all the gods, and until 30 days, any request to God or man, until 30 days can only be made to you, O king. And if not, they will be caused to be hurled into the den of lions. So these guys figure out how to do this. And they say, man, this is a great opportunity. The only person that you can make a request of is the king, and we'll do this for 30 days. So Darius played into this. He is governed by laws, unlike Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold. The Persian Empire had rules and regulations, and they couldn't be violated. So he's thinking, well, this is great. They have to ask me for everything for 30 days. Now, O king, verse 8, cause this regulation to be set and sign the writing so that it cannot be caused to be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Verse 9. So this is what they plan to do. Thus before the king Darius, he signed the writing and the decree. So Darius said, man, this is great. Love it. We're going to do this. What a great law. I really appreciate your support. You guys are all on my team. I love it. We'll do this. So as soon as that happened, Daniel's faced with a choice. This evil legislation came into place. And what Daniel decided to do, you'll see in verses 10 and 11, and that's that he decided to do the right thing and face the consequences of it. So what do you do when your government tells you to do the wrong thing? Well, you do the right thing, and then you face the consequences for that. If you can, flee, hide, reason, petition, beg. But in the final analysis at 87, where's he going to run to? And especially with his high priority. So he made a decision, and that's that he would do what was the right thing. Verse 10. Daniel, when he knew of that which was signed, the writing, Daniel knew this law was in place. He went to his house, and he caused the windows to be flung wide open for himself. It's an emphatic term. He knows he's got an audience on this. And he goes up and he slams these windows wide open on his house in his upper room, so his second floor, towards Jerusalem. And three times in the day, he, kneeling on his knees, praying and causing thanks before his God. This was his custom. And all of this he was doing as a custom from long before this stupid law was put into place. So knowing the law, he purposely, consciously, publicly disobeys it, throws open his windows towards Jerusalem and prays to his God and gives thanks. Interesting that he puts both of those nuances together. What is prayer? Prayer is asking. There's two things you do when we pray. We call the action of talking to God praying, but biblically, prayer is asking. You haven't prayed until you ask for something, and then you give thanks. So it's two parts of when we talk to God. First is praying, asking, and the other is giving thanks. He does both of these. All right, now please, verse 11. And at once, immediately, these men assembled themselves, and they discovered Daniel praying, as if they were surprised, and making supplications however he wished before his God. So Daniel did what was right and chose to suffer. Now you'll see here in this last verses, verses 12 through 17, that what actually happened here was that Darius was deceived by his governors and his satraps and all these other guys that are listed, which were not part of the 120 or of the three, the other two governors and the rest of them, because they get looped into this thing as well. Verse 12, and this is a theme going through this chapter, in this section of the chapter. In that moment, immediately, you'll see that there's Daniel, as he writes this, describes it very vividly. In that moment, immediately, they went and speaking before the king about the decree of the king. Did you not sign a decree that every man that is requesting from any god or man within 30 days, except from you, O king, shall be caused to be hurled into the den of lions? There's the question. Answering the king and speaking, you're speaking the truth. This is a true word according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which you cannot revoke. Interesting use of pronouns here. They can't revoke it. He can't revoke it because it's a law. Immediately at that moment, answering before the king, they say, that Daniel, who is from the sons of the exiles of Judah, not does he show over you, O king, respect. Man, these guys are clever. So the problem isn't that Daniel broke the law. The problem is that he doesn't respect the king. And over the decree that you signed, and three times in the day, he is requesting and making his petition. At that moment, the king, when he heard the words, became greatly displeased at himself. So the king all of a sudden sees this for what it is. And he swats his golden crowned head. Oh, what was I thinking? I can't believe I fell for this. I can't believe that I believed these guys. Bunch of rascals. Look what they've done. And over Daniel, he set his heart to cause him to be delivered until the going down of the sun. We'd call that sunset. He was exhausting himself to cause him to be delivered. So when this took place, probably at the third time, so late in the afternoon, they all run to the king and say, here's what's happened, king, and this is the law, and you're stuck with this. And so the king tries to figure out how to get him out of this, and he works himself, exhausts himself until the decree has to be enacted. Nothing in the text says that, but apparently the law of the Medes and the Persians, it's enacted at that day. So he had until sunset, and he couldn't cause him to be delivered. Verse 15. And that moment, those men came as a group. They came as a group for their own benefit. To the king, saying to the king, and now it's interesting because they are instructing the king. They're commanding the king. This is a second masculine singular imperative, and it's intensive. You know. You know, it's a, so they're using the law as a protection against the king. This isn't going to end well for him, but you know the rest of the story. But they're going to get rid of Daniel, and that's the only thing that they can keep their focus on. You would think they'd be concerned about their career. They're not. They're more concerned about getting rid of Daniel. And I think that's a lot of times what anger and jealousy does to people. They lose complete perspective. Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and the Persians and every decree and every regulation that the king causes to be established cannot be changed. Do you think he didn't know that? But they want to remind him of that. And that moment, the king speaking caused Daniel to be brought in, and they hurled him to the lion's den, into the den of the lions. And while this was taking place, the king speaking, saying to Daniel, "May your God, whom you are devoted to, serving him continually, may he cause you to be delivered." So this lion's den is kind of cool. It's actually a cave underneath the area where this takes place. And it has a big, large gate at the mouth of the cave. And they filled it full of lions, one way in, one way out, through this large gate. But as a cave, there's a hole that they could drop people into this big cage where the lions are. This is execution on a very dramatic level. So whoever broke the Medes and the law, Medes and the Persians law, they would take them over and drop them down into this big cave full of very hungry, nasty, gnarly lions. This was the execution. So Darius can't figure out what to do. So verse 18, after he drops them in, a large single stone was caused to be brought, and it was laid over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his signet ring. They would put a big glob of wax on the edge, and the signet ring would go on it to show that it wasn't tampered with. And with the signet rings of his noblemen. So everybody put their ring in this. This is the execution of the law of the Medes and the Persians. This is going to be helpful after God delivers Daniel and we figure out who actually gets pitched into the lion's den. And with the signet ring of his noblemen, and that there may not be any changes as to the determination of the person Daniel. So since I started talking about deception, what do you do with these kinds of very slick individuals? Well, if Darius had stopped and thought about what he signed, he wouldn't have done it. So my recommendation, encouragement to us, is that the God of truth will help you discern the lie. So the two keys here to determining whether you're on the right track or not, I think have to do with prayer, asking the God of truth to help you figure out what's going on, and time. Give it some time. I can't tell you how many times I've said, well, let me think about this. Let me pray about this, and I'll go to sleep on it and present whatever it is to the Lord, and I'll come back with a different direction, having taken some time and thought about it and prayed about it. And that recipe is good for all kinds of things. My dad taught me that if the deal is so good that it's only good for that evening and at that moment, don't ever sign it because it's a scam. I took all my kids to high-pressure sales. Did you do that with your children? So timeshares. Oh, come on, we're going to this. oh, Dad, I don't, come on, we're going to sit through this, and at the end of it, I'll buy you fried chicken. Okay. And so we'd go to these sales pitches. Why? Well, because you arm your children against deception. And so, you know, learning to be able to say no, and I learned that from my dad. He was really, really good at figuring out what was wrong with the presentation. And he'd take the free steak dinners as well. One time he and Mom went to a very expensive steakhouse, high pressure sales, one-on-one, one salesperson with one couple. And they got to know each other, enjoyed the meal, and then the sales presentation started at the end of the meal. And my dad digs around in his pocket and he finds a little stubby pencil, and he turns over a piece of paper and he starts writing numbers based on this presentation. And when he's all done, he turns it around and he hands it to the salesman. And the salesman looks at it and he says, "Mr. Effa, you're the kind of person that owns companies like these. I hope you enjoyed your meal." So when you have these kinds of people who are calculated to deceive, like all of these guys in these verses, pray about it. The God of all truth will help you determine the error, and wait a little bit. Okay? Let's take